When Nobel Prize-winning physicist Richard Feynman was challenged about his habit of working through equations on paper rather than in his head, he responded with characteristic bluntness, "No, it's not a record, not a record of my thinking process. I actually did the work on the paper. It's not a record of anything. It's working." This insight cuts to the heart of a revolutionary idea. Our minds aren't confined to our skulls. Thinking happens through an intricate dance between our brains and the world around us. The Extended Mind by Annie Murphy Paul has become something of a cult classic among knowledge workers and educators since its 2021 publication, with figures like LinkedIn co-founder Reid Hoffman calling it a must-read for anyone who thinks. The book challenges our deeply ingrained cultural belief that intelligence is solely a product of brain power, offering instead a liberating alternative. We think best when we engage resources beyond our brains, our bodies, physical spaces, and relationships with others. What if the secret to becoming smarter isn't pushing our brains harder, but learning to extend our thinking beyond them? Our culture constantly urges us to use your head, a directive that appears everywhere from classrooms to boardrooms. This command, while well-intentioned, may be fundamentally misguided. The human brain, despite its remarkable capabilities, has significant limitations. It struggles with sustained attention, abstract concepts, and memory, precisely the cognitive functions modern life increasingly demands. The roots of our brain-centric view can be traced to a pivotal moment in 1946 when the ENIAC computer was unveiled at the University of Pennsylvania. Initially described as an electronic brain, the metaphor soon reversed. The brain began to be understood as a computer. This comparison became foundational to cognitive science, shaping how we understand thinking as information processing happening exclusively inside our heads. Another powerful metaphor emerged decades later, the brain as muscle. Carol Dweck's growth mindset research suggested that mental effort could strengthen neural connections just as physical exercise builds muscle. While this idea helpfully challenged fixed notions of intelligence, it still located thinking solely within the skull. Both metaphors, brain as computer and brain as muscle, share problematic assumptions: that the mind is sealed inside the head, that it determines thinking ability on its own, and that it possesses stable, measurable properties that can be ranked. These assumptions align with our culture's emphasis on individualism and our tendency to rank capabilities linearly. A more accurate metaphor might be the brain as magpie, gathering materials from its surroundings to construct thought. This analogy suggests intelligence isn't fixed, but shifts based on access to external resources and knowledge of their use. Growing scientific evidence indicates this is a more accurate model of human cognition, offering practical opportunities for improving how we think. Our typical response to cognitive challenges, doubling down on brain-bound thinking by urging ourselves to concentrate harder, is counterproductive. The smarter approach is learning to extend our thinking beyond the brain itself. While we already do this to some extent, we do so haphazardly, without intention or skill. Our bodies continuously gather and process far more information than our conscious minds can handle. This bodily wisdom helps us make sounder decisions, respond resiliently to challenges, and connect with others more sensitively if we learn to access it. Interoception, our awareness of internal bodily states, provides a wealth of information that typically remains unconscious. When we face important decisions, our bodies often recognize patterns before our conscious minds do. Neuroscientist Antonio Damasio demonstrated this in his famous gambling experiment, where participants' skin conductance spiked when considering risky choices well before they consciously understood the game's structure. Financial traders offer a compelling example of this phenomenon. Studies show that successful traders develop heightened awareness of subtle bodily signals that guide their split-second decisions. Rather than being distracted by physical sensations, these elite performers use their bodies as sophisticated information processing systems that bypass cognitive biases that often distort conscious thought. Interoceptive awareness can be deliberately cultivated through mindfulness practices, particularly the body scan technique. Research shows that naming our sensations, affect labeling, reduces physiological arousal and calms the amygdala. This practice creates a pathway to knowledge we already possess, but that typically remains inaccessible, knowledge about ourselves, others, and our environment. Beyond decision-making, interoception plays a crucial role in resilience. Studies by Martin Paulus reveal that people with high resilience possess keener interoceptive awareness than those who struggle or burn out. Elite performers like distance swimmer Diana Nyad demonstrate distinctive brain patterns, intense anticipatory responses before stressors, but relative calm during and after challenges, allowing them to manage energy efficiently. Our emotions, too, are constructed partly from bodily sensations. As William James famously noted, we feel sorry because we cry, angry because we strike, afraid because we tremble. Greater interoceptive awareness allows for richer emotional experiences and the ability to reinterpret sensations adaptively, like reframing nervousness as excitement, a technique shown to improve performance on tests, public speaking, and even singing. Movement doesn't just transport our brains from place to place. It fundamentally enhances how we think. Our educational and work environments often treat the body as irrelevant to intellectual activity, but research increasingly shows this separation is artificial and counterproductive. Consider the classroom transformation at Vallecito Elementary School in California, where traditional desks were replaced with standing workstations. Despite initial hesitation, teachers reported students became more alert and engaged. This approach recognizes that suppressing natural movement actually increases cognitive load. The brain must work harder to stay still. Research confirms this. Subjects instructed not to move show increased prefrontal cortex activity and perform worse on cognitive tasks. For children with ADHD, whose brains are chronically under-aroused, movement serves as self-regulation. Julie Schweitzer's research showed increased movement correlated with better cognitive performance. Similarly, fidgeting helps everyone modulate arousal levels, with researcher Catherine Isbister suggesting these embodied self-regulation techniques can induce positive moods conducive to creative thinking. Exercise offers even more dramatic cognitive benefits. Moderate intensity physical activity improves attention, verbal fluency, problem solving, and memory through increased arousal, blood flow, and neurochemical release, benefits lasting up to 2 hours. Yet we rarely leverage this connection, separating exercise from cognitive work. School recess demonstrates this principle. Children return from playground time with improved focus and executive function, yet many schools reduce recess to increase seat time. Very intense exercise, sustained over time, can induce an altered state conducive to creative thought, called transient hypofrontality. When our resources are devoted to managing intense physical demands, the prefrontal cortex's influence temporarily diminishes. In this looser mental state, ideas mingle more freely and unexpected thoughts arise. Novelist Haruki Murakami, who runs marathons and logs 50 miles weekly, describes running in a void, precisely this phenomenon. Movement enhances memory through what researchers call the enactment effect. Our memory for what we've done physically is far more robust than for what we've merely heard. Professional actors demonstrate this principle. They achieve 98% accuracy recalling lines during performance by connecting dialogue to physical movements. Studies show non-actors can improve memory by 76% through movement-based learning compared to just 37% with deliberate memorization. Movement also deepens understanding. Psychologist Cyan Belock discovered this when studying hockey players, who showed facilitated comprehension when processing hockey-related language compared to non-players. Brain scans revealed hockey players activated their left dorsal premotor cortex, responsible for executing well-practiced movements, when hearing hockey terminology. This suggests people who move differently ultimately think differently. Our hands don't merely accompany speech, they actively shape and enhance our thinking. Gesture operates as a parallel language system that often precedes and facilitates verbal expression, serving as the leading edge of thought. When we gesture, we offload cognitive information onto our hands, freeing mental resources and expressing concepts that words alone cannot capture. Gestures carry extraordinary persuasive power by visually placing the speaker at the center of action. When entrepreneurs like Gabriel Hercule deploy symbolic gestures, pointing to eyes, then road, and beat gestures, pincer motions, air jabs during pitches, they're 12% more likely to secure funding. Gestures translate abstract ideas into embodied, human-scale terms that audiences can mentally simulate. Gesture was humanity's first language, flourishing before spoken words. Rather than being replaced by speech, gesture remains talk's ever-present partner, one that operates slightly ahead of verbal expression. Video analysis reveals we typically gesture before speaking related content, with listeners often understanding meaning from our hand movements before hearing our words. Children's gestures remarkably preview their cognitive development, with their newest and most advanced ideas often appearing first in hand movements before speech. In Susan Goldenmeadow's extensive video research, she discovered that when children's gestures mismatched their verbal explanations, like a girl verbally denying water conservation while making cupping motions indicating spatial understanding, they were in a transitional state of learning. Gesture supports not just novices, but experts venturing into uncharted intellectual territory. In a UC San Diego biochemistry lab studying blood clotting, researchers used specialized hand gestures to represent thrombin molecules, with fingers representing active sites and different hand configurations modeling potential molecular interactions. Gestures prove especially valuable for conveying spatial concepts that words fail to capture fully. Michelle Cook, a hearing-impaired geoscience professor, discovered that deaf students master geological concepts with remarkable speed due to spatial cognition skills developed through American Sign Language. Research confirms that both deaf and hearing signers demonstrate enhanced visual spatial processing abilities, suggesting that using structured gestural communication systems improves spatial thinking. We can elevate gesture from a dismissed adjunct to speech by consciously incorporating more hand movements in our communication. Research demonstrates that gesturing advances our understanding of abstract concepts, reduces cognitive load, improves memory, and enhances persuasive force. When audiences simultaneously hear speech and see gesture, their brains show stronger reactions than to either modality alone. As Jackson Pollock reached a breaking point in chaotic New York City, a visit to Long Island's peaceful East End provided the healing environment that transformed both his mental state and artistic approach. Moving to Springs, Long Island, allowed him to shift from easel painting to his revolutionary floor-based drip technique, producing masterpieces during what critics consider his career peak. Our attraction to particular natural environments reflects ancient evolutionary preferences. We universally prefer wide grassy expanses with scattered trees, water sources, and vantage points offering both prospect, long views, and refuge, protection. These aren't mere aesthetic preferences, but survival instincts that transcend culture, explaining why Japanese gardeners prune trees to resemble African species and desert homeowners irrigate to create savanna-like lawns. Nature enhances our thinking in measurable ways. Drivers on tree-lined roads recover from stress more quickly than those on billboard-cluttered routes. Nature exposure helps break cycles of rumination, obsessive negative thinking, as shown by Gregory Bratman's study, where participants who walked in natural settings showed reduced activity in brain regions associated with rumination compared to those who walked along busy roadways. Nature also improves focus and working memory. People who spent time in greenery catch more proofreading errors and score 20% higher on working memory tests than urban walkers. Even ADHD symptoms respond dramatically to doses of nature, with children showing Ritalin comparable improvements in concentration after just 20 minutes in a park. These benefits represent restoration of what psychologist William James called passive attention, the effortless, diffuse mental state evoked by nature's soft fascination, contrasting with the depleting, voluntary attention required by urban environments. By adopting an open monitoring stance outdoors, a curious, non-judgmental receptivity, we can maximize nature's restorative effects. Scientists are identifying precisely which features make nature natural to inform more cognitively enhancing design. Natural landscapes have less variation in hue, but more color saturation than urban settings. They present fewer straight lines, more curves, and densely clustered edges, like overlapping leaves, rather than evenly spaced ones, like windows on buildings. Though containing more visual information than built environments, nature presents this complexity in a way our brains process effortlessly, what researchers call perceptual fluency. Fractals, patterns that repeat at different scales, like fern fronds, appear abundantly in nature, but rarely in built environments. Nature's fractals typically fall in the mid-range of mathematical complexity, 1.3 to 1.5 on a 0 to 3 scale, precisely the range humans find most aesthetically pleasing. Viewing these mid-range fractals induces a wakefully relaxed state, simultaneously alert and at ease, and enhances problem-solving abilities. Extended time in nature fundamentally changes our relationship with time and future planning. People exposed to natural scenes show greater capacity to delay gratification and demonstrate less impulsivity than those viewing urban settings. Nature also alters our perception of time itself, making it feel more expansive and generous. Jonas Salk found inspiration for his polio vaccine breakthrough not in his basement laboratory, but in the tranquil architecture of a 13th century Italian monastery. This experience so profoundly affected him that when creating his own research institute with architect Louis Kahn, he modeled it after monastic spaces, designing an environment optimized for reflection and discovery with natural light, unobstructed laboratories, and ocean view studies. Beyond providing shelter, built interiors offer the quiet mental space necessary for sustained abstract thinking, an unnatural activity for humans evolutionarily adapted to think on the move. As human settlements grew denser, walls became cognitive necessities, not just physical barriers. Environmental psychologist Colin Ellard explains that walls protect us from the cognitive load of having to keep track of the activities of strangers, particularly important as we transitioned from small settlements to cities. The Renaissance studiolo exemplified the human need for private thinking space. Federico de Montefeltro's elaborate wood-inlaid study in 15th century Italy created a retreat from public duties into contemplation, surrounded by symbolic objects representing his aspirations. As urbanization increased, such thinking rooms became common across Europe, offering quiet spaces that made deep thinking possible. Beginning in the mid-20th century, the protective walls that had sheltered thinking for centuries began coming down. Open-plan spaces replaced discrete rooms in homes, schools, and especially offices, where 70 to 80% of American workers now labor without walls. This shift was partly economic. Open plans cost 50% less per employee, but also ideological, promoting the theory that removing barriers would increase communication, collaboration, and creativity. Research confirms that proximity does increase collaboration. Thomas Allen's famous Allen curve shows communication drops exponentially with distance, effectively ceasing beyond 165 feet. However, the coffee house model proves disastrous for complex cognitive work because it conflicts with human biology. Our brains evolve to monitor surroundings continuously, making us inherently distractible in open environments filled with precisely the stimuli that capture our attention most powerfully: novelty, speech, and social interactions. Beyond protection from distraction, walls provide privacy essential for creativity. The exhibitionist nature of open workspaces forces constant self-presentation that consumes mental resources, particularly for women who face heightened appearance expectations. Neuroscientist Moshe Barr found that cognitive load directly diminishes creativity. When mentally taxed, people produce statistically common, conventional ideas rather than original ones. When we work in spaces we consider our own, profound psychological and physiological changes occur. Like athletes experiencing the home advantage, people in their own territories exhibit higher testosterone levels and greater confidence. In familiar spaces, we're more productive, focused, and effective, even claiming 60 to 160% more value in negotiations. Effective work requires cycles of collaboration and isolation, what organizational psychologists call intermittent collaboration. While gathering information demands communication, the solution generation phase often suffers from excessive social contact. Research shows perpetually communicating teams generate consistently middling solutions, while those who isolate during ideation phases occasionally produce extraordinary breakthroughs. When we work in spaces we consider our own, profound psychological and physiological changes occur. Like athletes experiencing the home advantage, people in their own territories exhibit higher testosterone levels and greater confidence. In familiar spaces, we're more productive, focused, and effective, even claiming 60 to 160% more value in negotiations. Effective work requires cycles of collaboration and isolation, what organizational psychologists call intermittent collaboration. While gathering information demands communication, the solution generation phase often suffers from excessive social contact. Research shows perpetually communicating teams generate consistently middling solutions, while those who isolate during ideation phases occasionally produce extraordinary breakthroughs. Ben Pridmore, 3-time world memory champion, has demonstrated extraordinary feats like recalling almost 100 historic dates after brief study, memorizing the order of over 1,400 shuffled cards, and committing thousands of pi digits to memory. Despite these achievements, Pridmore ironically struggles with everyday memory tasks like remembering names, faces, and his lucky hat. His success relies on the ancient method of loci technique, which associates information with familiar physical locations, in his case, his childhood school. Our brains naturally use spatial frameworks to organize abstract thoughts and memories. Research shows the hippocampus maps both physical and conceptual spaces, as revealed when subjects watching the film Sliding Doors displayed brain activity identical to physical navigation. This spatial organization may explain infantile amnesia, our inability to recall early memories before we could move independently. The method of loci can be learned by anyone. Studies show ordinary people can more than double their memory capacity with 6 weeks of training. Professor Charles Wilson teaches civil liberties by having students link constitutional amendments to locations in their campus cafeteria, associating the First Amendment with soup, the first course, and the Second Amendment with bread slicing, visualizing bare arms. While we admire mental feats performed entirely in one's head, true genius often involves extending thinking into physical space. Concept mapping, pioneered by Joseph Novak in the 1970s, makes internal knowledge visible, helping us see relationships between ideas rather than getting lost in details. Robert Caro's wall-sized outline allows him to employ not just cognitive reasoning, but visceral powers of navigation and wayfinding, ancient evolved capacities that help us think more intelligently about abstract concepts. When we externalize our thoughts onto paper, we gain unique cognitive affordances unavailable to purely mental representations. This detachment gain, as psychologist Daniel Riseberg calls it, creates distance between ourselves and our thoughts, enabling us to see content more clearly and activate our powers of recognition. Studies with 8th-grade students illustrate how drawing scientific systems leads to deeper understanding by creating a check for completeness that reveals knowledge gaps. Physical manipulation of objects transforms thinking in ways purely mental simulation cannot match. When James Watson fashioned cardboard models of DNA's chemical bases in 1953, he discovered through hands-on manipulation that an adenine-thymine pair held together by two hydrogen bonds was identical in shape to a guanine-cytosine pair, a breakthrough insight leading to the double helix model. Psychologist Frederick Vallée-Tourangeau's research consistently shows that interactivity inevitably benefits performance across problem types, from arithmetic to creative insight challenges. People manipulating physical tokens experience reduced cognitive load, increased working memory, better learning and transfer, greater motivation, less anxiety, and faster solutions. Germany's renowned apprenticeship system has long been a cornerstone of its economic success, with 500,000 young Germans annually entering company-based programs to learn technical skills. At the University of Potsdam, professors transformed a computer science course with a 60% failure rate by reimagining it as a cognitive apprenticeship. Led by Professor Christoph Kreitz, they reduced lectures and increased small group sessions, where students actively performed computer science work under close supervision. The results were dramatic. Failure rates dropped from less than 10%. At Paris's Hôpital Universitaire Pitié Salpêtrière, medical students learn neurology by physically mimicking patient symptoms, tremors, jerky movements, slurred speech, under faculty guidance. This mime-based role-play training produces remarkable results. Students recall neurological signs significantly better than those receiving conventional instruction, while developing deeper understanding and greater empathy. Our modern suspicion of imitation contrasts sharply with classical education, where it was revered as a rigorous path to excellence. Roman schooling, documented by Quintilian around AD 35, centered on systematic imitation. Students would read, memorize, and recite model texts, then transform them through paraphrasing, translation, compression, elaboration, and finally, writing in the admired author's style. Despite our cultural celebration of originality, research increasingly validates imitation's effectiveness. Finance research shows that copying Warren Buffett's investment choices yields returns averaging 10% above market performance. Imitators gain 5 key advantages. They let others filter available options, can draw from diverse solutions rather than being tied to one approach, avoid others' mistakes, access competitors' best strategies, and save substantial resources. Even our most celebrated innovators succeed through skilled imitation. In 1979, Steve Jobs visited Xerox PARC and recognized solutions to Apple's challenges: networking platforms, user-friendly graphics, and the mouse. Jobs then simplified Xerox's three-button, $300 mouse into a one-button, 15 version that worked on any surface, demonstrating what management professor Oded Shenkar identifies as the three steps of solving the correspondence problem: identifying an analogous solved problem, analyzing why the solution works, and adapting it to new circumstances. Human imitation is far more complex than once thought. Unlike other animals, children are highly selective about whom they imitate, preferring knowledgeable, competent models, but strikingly unselective about what they imitate. Humans are high-fidelity copiers who faithfully reproduce even seemingly unnecessary steps, a tendency called over-imitation that increases with age. This apparently irrational behavior actually serves important functions. It allows us to learn opaque cultural practices whose purposes aren't immediately obvious and helps perpetuate social customs. Nobel Prize-winning physicist Carl Wieman discovered that, despite his expertise in creating Bose-Einstein condensates, he couldn't effectively teach undergraduates to think like physicists through traditional lectures. The breakthrough came when he noticed how his graduate students transformed into flexible thinkers through intense social engagement in his lab, debating, advising, and sharing knowledge with peers. Human thinking is fundamentally social. Our brains evolved to think with others, teaching, arguing, and exchanging stories. Even our internal monologue resembles an internalized conversation. Social information is encoded differently in the brain than non-social information, stored in distinct regions and remembered more accurately, the social encoding advantage. Despite mounting evidence linking social interaction to intelligent thought, our educational and work environments remain trapped in brain-bound approaches. We're asked to produce facts, make arguments, and process information without social context, ignoring our actual cognitive strengths. While humans struggle with abstract concepts, we excel at thinking about people. The Wasson selection task demonstrates this perfectly. When presented as an abstract logic problem, only 10% solve it correctly. But when framed as a social scenario about enforcing drinking age rules, success rates jumped to 75%. Teaching is a natural human instinct, evident across cultures and throughout history. From birth, we unconsciously signal our intent to instruct through eye contact and vocal changes. Teaching others creates powerful learning benefits for the teacher. This explains why firstborn children average 2.3 IQ points higher than younger siblings. They gain cognitive advantages from teaching their younger brothers and sisters. Arguing, when done properly, is another powerful social tool for extending our thinking. Most humans perform poorly when asked to reason alone, falling prey to confirmation bias and other cognitive flaws. But according to Hugo Mercier and Dan Sperber's argumentative theory of reasoning, these aren't design flaws, but features. We evolved not to solve logic puzzles alone, but to persuade others and detect when we're being misled. Stories provide another powerful social tool for enhancing cognition. When students learn scientific concepts through narratives that capture human motives and choices, like Marie and Pierre Curie's discovery of radioactivity, they understand material more thoroughly and remember it more accurately than when learning from conventional textbook presentations. Our brains process stories by running mental simulations, activating emotional and motor regions as if we were experiencing events ourselves. Joshua Aronson, following his father Elliot's path into social psychology, found himself experiencing what he called conditional stupidity when meeting with his distinguished Princeton advisor, losing 10 or 15 IQ points upon entering the professor's office. This humiliating experience led him to co-develop the influential concept of stereotype threat with Claude Steele, demonstrating how awareness of negative stereotypes about one's group temporarily diminishes intellectual performance. This research reveals a crucial truth. Intelligence isn't a fixed lump of something in our heads, but rather a transaction, a fluid interaction between our brains, bodies, spaces, and relationships. Studies show that mental extensions can counteract challenges like stereotype threat through techniques explored throughout the book, cognitive reappraisal of bodily signals, environmental cues of belonging, and structured expert feedback. Extensions are most powerful when combined into mental routines, drawing on our full range of extraneural resources. We should adopt habits that offload information whenever possible, externalizing it through writing, physical navigation of wall-sized outlines, embodied gestures, or social distribution among teammates. We should transform abstract information into tangible artifacts we can manipulate and deliberately alter our own states to match cognitive tasks, perhaps exercising before learning, seeking nature for creativity, or finding argument partners to test ideas. We must recognize the brain evolved for sensing, moving, navigating, and socializing, not abstract thinking. We extend our minds by re-embodying information, attending to interoceptive signals, re-spatializing it, creating memory palaces or concept maps, and re-socializing it, turning internal dialogues into actual human exchanges. Scientists can now measure differences in people's capacity to extend their minds using variations on conventional IQ tests. A groundbreaking study by Dutch psychologists and philosopher Andy Clark created an interactive version of the Raven Advanced Progressive Matrices test that allowed test takers to manipulate puzzle pieces on screen. Those who actively extended their thinking by manipulating the pieces performed better, engaging in productive loops between external actions and internal evaluations. Recognizing the extended mind has profound implications for social justice. If intelligence depends so heavily on access to extraneural resources, then inequality in these resources becomes harder to justify. The extended mind concept helps us reconsider philosopher John Rawls' famous veil of ignorance thought experiment by loosening our identification with what we consider innate intelligence. Unlike natural intelligence, which we see as inseparable from our identity, access to mental extensions is more readily understood as a matter of chance or circumstance. This perspective fosters empathy. There, but for the grace of God, go I, suggesting that acknowledging the extended mind might lead us to embrace the extended heart and a more equitable distribution of cognitive resources.